I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in 2016, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district in western Pennsylvania by almost 20 points, helping to consolidate his win for the White House. Last fall, conservative Republican Congressman Tim Murphy, who had represented the 18th for eight terms, resigned in disgrace after it was revealed he had urged a woman with whom he was having an affair to have an abortion. That has set the stage for a closely watched special election for the 18th on March 13th, pitting conservative Republican Rick Saccone, who is a state representative, against newcomer Democrat Connor Lamb. Chris Botter has been covering this race for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and joins us once again on Radio Times. Chris, nice to have you back with us on the show.
It's really good to be here with you.
Describe Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district for us.
This is a sprawling district that ranges across southwestern Pennsylvania, across parts of four different counties. Allegheny County, which is includes Pittsburgh, is one of them, but also Greene, Washington, and Westmoreland. It is an almost entirely white district, made up of a combination of rural areas, sort of post-industrial and industrial small towns, and some affluent suburbs in Allegheny and portions of Washington County. As you said, it went 20 points for Donald Trump by 20 points in 2016. It also went by 20 points for Mitt Romney in 2012, although it was a somewhat different 20 points, which we can talk about a little bit later because that has a lot to do with the campaign strategy being used by both parties here.
Deep red, would that describe the 18th, or is that too monochromatic?
I think certainly a good shade of red, but not as deep as, say, Bill Schuster's district, the 9th district, which is even includes Fayette County, is even whiter and more rural in parts. But it has been a solidly Republican district, even though it has a Democratic registration edge. There are a lot of kind of old-school Democrats out here who skew more conservative on social issues and have been trending Republican over recent cycles.
Until his resignation, was Tim Murphy pretty popular? He had won a number of times.
Yeah, he hadn't really been challenged much, and Mr. Murphy had sort of struck an interesting balance. He was conservative, as you mentioned, on issues like abortion, but he also managed to garner himself support from some unions. He had been on kind of the steelworker side on trade questions and things like that. Had been a member of the Steel Caucus in the U.S. House, so he had kind of pulled off an interesting balancing act of being kind of conservative on social issues, but a little union friendly on some other economic matters.
And how much of a scandal was that when he resigned?
It was big. I mean, it was my paper, a colleague of mine here, who originally reported that he had gotten involved with a woman in an extramarital affair, and he probably could have survived that, but as a result of our reporting, it developed that, as you say, there had been evidence that he had encouraged his mistress to have an abortion during a pregnancy scare, and that was really a problem for a lot of folks. There are a lot of people in the 18th and in southwestern Pennsylvania generally who take abortion seriously and really did not like the implication that he might be practicing one thing in his personal life while espousing beliefs for everybody else.
That, of course, has put the 18th in the spotlight. This is yep. A race that is getting national attention. Can you feel it over there?
Yeah, you don't have to feel it. Just turning on a TV.
I was wondering about that.
It's enough to let you know. The advertising, especially on the Republican side here, from national Republicans, has been intense. Less so on the Democratic side, and that's really sort of setting up a pretty key dynamic here. For you and I and for a lot of the national press, and for Republicans as well, they're really trying. We're all looking at this race as sort of a litmus test on how Donald Trump is doing in what would seem like a kind of quintessentially Trumpy district. The campaign of the Democrat, Connor Lamb, is really doing everything it possibly can to sort of play down that interpretation. They're really kind of going out of their way to play down the national implications of this. If you listen to Mr. Lamb, it's not a race about Donald Trump at all. If anything, he's more interested in having a race that's about the congressional leadership. To hear him talk, it's more about a race between himself and Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House there. there. And that reflects a calculation, I think, by Democrats, which is that Donald Trump, remains popular, maybe not as popular as he was a year or two ago, but popular in the district. But everyone kind of hates Paul Ryan. Democrats who voted for Donald Trump don't necessarily love Paul Ryan, and a lot of Republicans aren't all that excited about him either, although for different reasons. So you really have, Rick Saccone kind of running hand-in-hand with Donald Trump and with national Republicans, but a somewhat warier approach from Connor Lamb, who has also said if he were elected, he would not support Nancy Pelosi as the leader of House Democrats any further. And that is a response to a really aggressive campaign by Republicans to link him to Nancy Pelosi, who's very unpopular in the district.
Well, you took my question away, because that's okay, that's perfectly fine. If they're talking about Paul Ryan, how much is Nancy Pelosi's name coming up in the ads that are opposed to Connor Lamb?
Almost every single one.
Really?
You would almost think that Nancy Pelosi were running for the 18th congressional district out here. I mean, just every ad. Republicans have very shrewdly discovered that Lamb, the candidate's last name, is also a word that means a young sheep. Their ads are really driving that home. He'll be a sheep for Nancy Pelosi. There's a lot of bleeding coming out of people's TV sets these days. Little animations with lambs and sheep running around and slavishly following the lead of national Democrats.
I can see it now. Tell us a bit about Rick Saccone. He is a member of the legislature. One quote that I ran into that he said about himself, that he was Trump before Trump was Trump.
Yep. Yeah, and he is, as I say, very very anxious to attach himself to Mr. Trump. He has been a state House representative from a sort of post-industrial community outside of Pittsburgh, Elizabeth, for about 6 or 8 years now. A very conservative guy socially, very conservative on issues of abortion. He's probably best known for sponsoring legislation that originally, as it was originally written, would have required public schools to display "In God We Trust" somewhere. That language got softened a little bit, but that was his initial intent there. Very strong proponent of gun rights. He's very popular with the NRA and then a few gun rights groups who make the NRA look, like the Brady campaign to limit gun ownership.
Really?
Staunchly conservative guy out here, and very ideological in that sense, whereas Connor Lamb is stressing sort of a much more pragmatic approach to government, to governance. And that, too, I think sort of reflects the difficulties that a Democrat has running in this district.
Connor Lamb is 33. Rick Saccone is 59. Connor Lamb, a former, I guess he's a U.S. attorney, Marine veteran. What are his politics?
This is the good question, right? Sometimes it's a little bit hard to tell. I think it would be safe to describe him as a moderate/centrist Democrat. If you were to ask him, say, about gun issues, as I did, he would say, I think there are some control mechanisms and regulations that reasonable Americans could agree upon, and it's a conversation we have to have. But trying to pin him down beyond that sometimes can be a little bit difficult. He describes himself as being personally pro-life, but notes that Roe v. Wade is the law of the land and doesn't feel obliged to impose his personal views on that issue on other people, which sounds to me like a pro-choice position, but that's not the way he's choosing to describe or characterize it.
Have they had debates, these two?
They have not, although there is one scheduled for early March, which I believe will be televised by our local ABC affiliate here in town.
Now, the president visited the district. I believe the vice president was there as well. What kind of response did they get?
That's interesting. So the president's visit especially was billed as an official event. He was nominally here, at least, to talk about all the benefits from the tax cut plan passed by the Republicans late last year. So his mentions of Mr. Saccone were very brief and cursory. Mr. Pence was here last week and was here for what was billed explicitly as a campaign rally. He basically touted Mr. Saccone as being an ally of the administration, or at least would be one if he were in Congress. He kind of raked Mr. Lamb over the coals on a few occasions. What was interesting about Mr. Pence's visit was the candidate himself, Rick Saccone, only spoke for about 2 minutes at the event. He was almost kind of an afterthought at his own campaign rally in that sense. And I think that, again, sort of reflects there have been concerns amongst national Republicans about just how much excitement Rick Saccone is drumming up out here. He was out fundraised by more than 2-1 by Mr. Lamb late last year, which is surprising. This is, again, it's a comfortably Republican district, but Mr. Lamb has ginned up a lot of excitement from a Democratic base here, and there's concern that, you know, that Rick Saccone just isn't doing that he just has not sort of figured out how to scale up from a state legislative race to a you know, national federal legislative race. So what you've got is a lot of these guys coming in and from the national side and really trying to, you know, carry him across the finish line. If Connor Lamb's outraising him 2-1, then I think nationally Republicans are outspending national Democrats here by something like 5-1.
Wow. I mean, any Democrats of note that have come in for Connor Lamb?
Well, this is interesting. The only one so far is Joe Kennedy III, who folks will remember from having really shiny lips after the State of the Union address.
That poor guy. It's a thankless job to follow up any presidential State of the Union.
Yeah, this is why I'll never be on national TV. This is as much exposure with you right now, Marty, as I've ever
gotten. That's why they invented radio. I love it.
But when Joe Kennedy was here, interestingly, and I think this kind of points up what I was saying before, Connor Lamb's people did not notify anybody in the press about this visit. He just sort of appeared all of a sudden at an event for campaign volunteers. I think your colleague at NPR, Scott Detrow, was asking the campaign the day before, "Hey, you got any events I should see?" And the Lamb people said no. So there is this attempt. Yeah, there is this attempt, it seems like, to really kind of not affiliate or attach himself to national level Democrats, because national level Democrats just are not popular in the 18th district. So that's what you've got is this sort of conundrum for him. He'd clearly like to have, you know, financial support from across the country, which Democrats have gotten in other special elections in recent months. But he doesn't necessarily want to be tied to these folks. And it's hard to think of a Democrat other than maybe Joe Biden whose appearance in the district would really help Connor Lamb. Whereas Rick Saccone's got the president, the vice president. There's talk that cabinet secretaries from the White House may also appear in the district. So we'll see how that goes.
About a minute or so before we have to say goodbye, are voters engaged?
You know, it's always hard to determine that. I tell you that I see a lot of lawn signs up in the South Hills of Pittsburgh, which is where I live, and they're mostly Connor Lamb lawn signs. You know, it's I would say they're probably more engaged on the Democratic side, just anecdotally at this point, and maybe more engaged than most special elections really manage to attract people, because there is this perception that, you know, there's kind of national stuff at stake here.
And lawn signs still mean something?
You know, there's a spirited debate about that. You know, they don't vote, but I'm sure if you're a Connor Lamb supporter, it's nice to look out and see that stuff out there. And the vast majority of the largest chunk of votes out in the 18th district are in the South Hills and in the suburban areas of Allegheny County. So he's really got to do well there. And seeing lawn signs doesn't hurt the perception that he is.
Well, Chris Botter, always enjoy talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's has been covering, among other things, the 18th Congressional District in Western Pennsylvania. He writes for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. We'll be talking more about Pennsylvania politics from a Democratic perspective. We'll be talking about the Republicans sometime in the next couple of weeks. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Marcel Groen, head of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, just stepped down, saying that Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf no longer wanted him to serve as chair because of how he had handled sexual harassment allegations involving members of the legislature. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court denied a request by Pennsylvania Republican lawmakers to stay a ruling by the state Supreme Court that called congressional district maps unconstitutional. Now the legislature has until the end of the week to redraw those maps and send them to the governor for his signature. If not, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court will draw the congressional boundaries for them. And looking ahead to November, there are a number of state and congressional races in Pennsylvania that could be competitive with the announcement of some half a dozen retirements. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is T.J. Rooney. He was Democratic Party chair from 2003 to 2010, former state representative for Pennsylvania's 133rd district. He's a political strategist for the Rooney Novak Group. T.J. Rooney, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us by telephone is John Baer, and he's a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. John, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Hey, TJ.
Hey, good morning.
And also with us, Ryan Grimm, and he's joining us from the D.C. Bureau Chief, or he is D.C. Bureau Chief at The Intercept, and joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And he wrote a recent story in The Intercept called The Dead Enders about how the Democratic Party leaders keep out progressive candidates, including the race for the 16th Congressional District, which is near Lancaster, P.A. Ryan Grimm, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's good to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about Pennsylvania politics, focusing largely on the Democrats. TJ, let me begin with you and begin with the fact that the head of the Democratic Party, a job you had, has stepped down, basically saying the governor didn't want him to do this anymore. How significant?
Well, I mean, the grand scheme of winning and losing elections, it's not very significant at all. There's two things, I think, that when you find yourself as leader of a state party, Democrat or Republican, number one, you should never become the story. Unless you're throwing an elbow or poking somebody in the eye, you want to kind of stay out of things like that. And number two, more important than number one, you've got to be able to keep up with the governor. And, you know, this governor is absolutely unequivocal when it comes to calling balls and strikes, especially when it comes to men engaging in wholly inappropriate behavior. He's called for Republicans and Democrats across the board to step aside when they face those allegations. So you got to be able, at the very least, you got to be able to keep up and keep pace with the governor. And I think that's what brought about the changes.
John, I'd be curious about how you see this. I do want to move on to what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision on congressional districts. What's your response to the resignation?
Well, I agree with TJ that, the significance is going to be very short-lived and really won't have an impact on the outcome or the direction of elections. And, you know, the larger question is how relevant are the parties anymore anyway? I mean, we see, thanks to social media, the curse of all civilization, the whole world is different, and parties just don't have the same clout and presence that they once did. Marcel is Marcel. Look, a very likable guy, very smart guy, always spoke his mind, which was a joy for journalists. And this time he misspoke it because he wasn't following the titular head of the party, which is, of course, the incumbent governor.
And that was an interview with at the Daily News. Ryan Grimm, let me pick up on something that John Baer said, which is that parties just are not as relevant as they used to be. And your article is about this split between the National Democratic Party and local party activists. How do you see the party?
Yeah, that's a great point. And, when you were talking earlier about the party keeping progressives out of races, another way to look at it would be the party attempting to keep progressives out of races, but failing badly to do so. And that goes back to what you're talking about, that parties don't have the same machine-like control over primaries and over who gets to run that they used to. And the race that you were just mentioning, Pennsylvania 16, which is mostly Lancaster, but also Reading is kind of gerrymandered into there as well. There's a party-backed candidate, Christina Hartman, who ran in 2016 and lost there and now is running again. And, has the typical trappings of establishment support. She's got the backing of Emily's List. She's got a lot of Washington consultants who are behind her. She's got a lot of high net worth donors. She has some labor backing from the district. And so she set off raising a lot of money and assumed she was going to cruise to a primary victory. A woman named Jess King wound up running with the support of this couple of grassroots organizations, Make the Road PA, kind of an immigrant rights group in the area, Lancaster Stands Up, a kind of a a grassroots progressive group that kind of sprung out of the Trump election, but also, you know, kind of drew heavily on the anti-pipeline organizing activity.
Right.
And all of a sudden, in the fourth quarter of this last year, Jess King raised more money than Christina Hartman, which changes absolutely everything. Because you can say, well, okay, sure, we would prefer a more progressive candidate, but they just don't have the money. And, you know, and money is what walks. And if you don't have it, forget about it. And so, unfortunately, we're going to have to go with these candidates who can raise bigger bucks. But now you're flipping that on its head by having a small dollar base giving more money than the high net worth base giving to the opponent.
Well, let me pick up on several things, and I do want to get to what the Supreme Court did. But just picking up that on that notion, T.J. Rooney, Democratic Party has registration advantage huge in Pennsylvania. And yet when you look, for instance, at the congressional delegation, it's a hugely minority party there. What does that tell us about the state of the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania?
Well, it tells us that we were on the wrong side of the 2010 elections. And to the winner, heretofore, to the winner go the spoils. Now, the court has, in the last 24 hours, the Supreme Court in the last 24 hours, has taken some action that may lead to a correction to that end. But at the end of the day, you know, the party in control at the end of that cycle is the party that determines how the districts get drawn. And in their case, they had everything possibly going for them. And this is the net effect, the net result, which is obviously not appropriate in the eyes of both the Pennsylvania and United States Supreme Courts.
John, you know the legislature like nobody else. They have until the end of the week to come up with new maps. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's not going to happen. The last time it took a year to draw new maps is that, you know, unless the Lord Christ comes down, they're not going to do it in a couple of days. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in doing it. I mean, a couple of the Republican leaders in the Senate have already said, you know, it's clear that no matter what we do, the Supreme Court's going to overrule it anyway and draw their own map. So why should we go through all the toil and turmoil to get it done? I'd be very surprised if there's any product at the end of the week.
Which means literally then the Pennsylvania Supreme Court will draw the congressional maps, John?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the case involves, there's something like 500 maps that were introduced into evidence earlier in the case. So what they could do is very easily just pick one of those that's to their liking rather than restructure the whole thing and start from scratch. So they have enough evidence if they want to do a map in a hurry, they can turn one.
And when you mean to their liking, the Democrats hold a majority on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Does that mean to the liking for the Democratic Party, John?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah? I mean, no question about it?
None.
Because that's just the way maps are drawn?
That's the way politics are drawn.
That's the way. And you're shaking your head vigorously, T.J.
Yeah, no, he's, John's exactly, there's nothing remotely incorrect of what about what he's asserted. Now,
there are no neutral maps?
Well, no, there are maps that will, in the view of the court, I would assume, meet the test in a way that's acceptable, where you have communities of interest not separated, where you have appropriate deviations, and they don't, and those districts, the net effect, if I had to guess, and John can correct me if he thinks I'm wrong, but the net effect is that we'll see a pickup of two right away, we'll turn the 15th into a toss-up, and that's how the cycle will likely play itself out.
Ryan, I'm curious about your perspective, a more national perspective. How do you see this decision by the U.S. Supreme Court and obviously its impact in Pennsylvania?
It's coming at an interesting time because you have In districts, well, so to back up, gerrymandering works because you spread your supporters out across the state in a way that gives you comfortable 10-point wins in normal years, and then gives your opposition huge, like 70-point wins. So that's the way that you bunch all of your opponent's voters into a few districts, and then you spread out and you plan to win by 10 or so. But if you run into a wave and you've only given yourself a 10-point cushion, then all of a sudden races that you had set up to make unwinnable for your opponents all of a sudden become winnable. And Pennsylvania 16 is kind of an interesting case of that. You know, that Hartman lost by, I think, 11 in 2016, and Democrats think they could genuinely pick this district up. It'd be a long shot. But they think that if there's enough of a wave, they could pick this thing up. But the redistricting is probably going to, you know, depending on how it shakes out, you know,
right.
nobody has any idea, but you might, you know, that district might lose Reading and it might pick up, you know, more of the eastern, more conservative region there and kind of end up benefiting Republicans in that district to the benefit of Democrats in surrounding areas. So this kind of, across the country, this revision of gerrymandering is coming at an interesting time. In Virginia, Republicans got themselves in trouble the same way. They gave themselves 5 to 10 point cushions around the state to try to gerrymander it, but then they lost so badly, but they lost by 10 points, right. that they almost wound up losing the entire chamber down there.
John, I saw a tweet about Republicans threatening to impeach members of the state Supreme Court. Can you clear that up or address that in any way?
Yeah, there's a conservative Republican House member who has a resolution, I guess, that he wants to put in to impeach the Democratic members of the state Supreme Court. We can sum that up by basically saying good luck with that.
Oh, you're saying this is not going anywhere?
No.
And why not? Just it's off the reservation?
Because they haven't done anything that's impeachable, in my view. Not an attorney, but it just seems a stretch.
TJ, you want to add to that?
No, it's a complete stretch. It's just one of those things that in legislatures and in the Congress of the United States, crazy stuff pops up every day. This is one of them.
Well, and just picking up, and John, let me go back to you. I think it was Mother Jones reported that Joe Scarnati, he's Senate president, apparently gave money to a Republican, Sally Mundy, who sits on the court. Also, David Wecht, apparently when he was campaigning, criticized the way Pennsylvania was gerrymandered. It does raise questions about how we elect judges, justices in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it sure does, Marty, and it's a point I've made in the past, and as this current chaos was unfolding, I've made it again. We're one of only a handful of states that elect judges at all levels, and when we elect judges, that means they have to campaign, and so they expose themselves to their true beings, and it also means they need money, which means that there are people that can become at least apparently compromised in giving and taking. And so this whole episode, in my view, might kind of refuel interest in merit selection of judges and do away with at least the election of appellate judges. Those would be statewide offices. So that might be a good thing that comes out of all this.
That's John Baer. He's columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, joining us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Ryan Grimm is D.C. Bureau Chief at The Intercept, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And T.J. Rooney is with us here in our Philadelphia studios, and he's a former Democratic Party Chair of Pennsylvania, also former state representative and currently political strategist for the Rooney Novak Group. And you are listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I was thinking, and I'm looking at you, TJ, is assuming the maps are redrawn, this is an election year. I don't know whether they can get redrawn by the end of the week and then get approved, but does this not throw the midterms completely up in the air?
Sure. As I think it was Ryan suggested in his earlier comments, you could theoretically be an announced candidate in one of our districts today and find yourself no longer a resident of that district by week's end. So sure, but you know, truthfully, Marty, I don't think there's a whole lot of people with their crying towels out thinking that some aspiring politicians are going to be, you know, discomforted for a couple of days. So it is what it is. It's you know, we've been down this road in the past in other states, as has been talked about. North Carolina is another example of a state where their districts are in flux and the courts have intervened.
Let me get Andrew. Looks like Andrew's calling us from Morrisville. Andrew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, does this redistricting affect the state Senate, the state legislature, and the federal congressional seats, races?
John Baer, you want to take that?
Just congressional at this point.
And that's where it gets complicated because they're different districts, right, TJ?
Oh, absolutely, it is. But for the purpose of the caller, and as John said, it is specifically and exclusively limited to the congressional districts, not the state legislative districts. At least for now.
At least for now. Andrew, I appreciate calling in, and this is where it gets complicated. An email from Stu: the whole idea of redistricting is corrupt. Make all districts conform to county borders and never change them. And Ryan, if I can turn to you, and I've said this before in Radio Times years ago. In fact, John Baer was often our guest. We would talk about redistricting or gerrymandering, and no one would call. And now we just mention the word, and the phones explode. Why do you think this has become such an important issue to so many people?
Well, since 2010, since that kind of radical redrawing of the lines across the country, which was enabled by kind of technological breakthroughs that took a 200-year bipartisan effort on, and kind of catapulted it into what we have today, where you can go block by block, house by house, and just cherry pick precisely the district that you want. So instead of having politicians who respond to their voters, the politicians just find new voters. Mm-hmm. And many people believe that is what has created so much of the dysfunction in Washington, the inability to come to an agreement on something. The president wants, for instance, to solve the Dream Act situation. The Democrats say they want to solve it. Most Republicans say they want to solve it. You have majorities in both chambers for it. It can't get done. You had the Children's Health Insurance Program lapse for 6 months, a very popular program. And so people look at that and they say, well, something's going on. And I think one of the things that's going on is the way that they've gerrymandered these districts so that you have so many Republicans who only have to cater to their primary supporters. As long as they can win, 50% of the 25% of the electorate that comes out in a primary, and those are the most engaged. They're Fox News watchers, or they might think Fox News is too liberal by this point. And you please them, and then you're elected, and then so then you have no other pressures, and with no other pressures, governing collapses.
We have 30 seconds. Go ahead, TJ.
To put a cap on a point you made earlier, Marty, I think one thing that stands out for a lot of Pennsylvanians is what you alluded to. We have majority registration of roughly 1 million voters. When you look at statewide elections, Democrats do quite well in statewide elections. And then you look at the districts, and the districts are not reflective at all of what goes on when people go to the polls. And I think that's starting to catch on with a lot of folks. And it's just so out of whack. It's just so egregious. There comes a tipping point, and I think we hit it.
It's about the math, in a way? The math doesn't add up?
Sure. If you look at the historic margins that the Republicans have in the General Assembly, and you look at the voting trends of Pennsylvania voters, there's something completely, completely out of whack. It'll always be a little out of whack. This is way out of whack.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me just recap here. The number one story here in Pennsylvania: pressure is on the legislature to redraw congressional boundaries by the end of the week. And if not, the state Supreme Court could do it for them. A number of retirements in Pennsylvania have opened up a number of races. Do voters want candidates who lean left, right, or down the middle? And let me reintroduce our three guests. TJ Rooney is a political strategist for the Rooney Novak Group and a former Democratic Party chair in Pennsylvania. John Baer, columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he is joining us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Ryan Grimm is D.C. bureau chief at The Intercept. He's down in Washington at the NPR studios. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation, talking about Pennsylvania politics, focusing largely but not exclusively on Democrats. We'll be talking more about the Republicans in a couple of weeks. TJ, let me go to you. And just for people that know nothing about Pennsylvania and its politics, it is described as a swing state. It's kind of has bluish, I guess, blue cities, purple suburbs, red rural parts of the state. How would you describe overall the politics of Pennsylvania?
The politics of Pennsylvania is, I think, is historically moderate. Overall, if you take the state as a whole, our politics are moderate. They'll swing when they do swing. They'll swing from center to right of center to center left of center. Now we have seen, we'll say that we have seen since the last reapportionment decidedly bigger majorities in the General Assembly, and therefore with the bigger majorities, you're going to see a more conservative. Like we talked about, there's some resolution to impeach Supreme Court, that kind of stuff. But again, Pennsylvania in national elections and statewide elections is the epitome of a swing state.
To you, John, although there are no women in the congressional delegation, what does that tell us about Pennsylvania?
Well, it tells us that generally we're a little bit further right. I mean, the problem is, it's the politics of Pennsylvania is like a wave. I mean, in the southeast, it's one thing. In the middle of the state, it calms down. And in the western part of the state, it's increasingly popping up a different color. So you go to blue to kind of pinkish to kind of reddish as you move across the state. And Pennsylvania, for some reason, has never been female friendly when it comes to the election box. I mean, we have one of the lowest rates of women representatives in our state legislature in America, the lowest in the Northeast. We have, as you mentioned, no members of our congressional delegation. We've never elected a woman United States Senator. We've never elected a woman governor. And so there's something at work there that takes us back. I think it's we're an older state, a more traditional state. TJ is right, moderate in many, many ways, but in other ways a little bit less than moderate.
Is it the women, John, don't run, or if they run, they don't get elected?
Well, I mean, I think that's changing. I think we'll see a change this time. Women have run, not nearly in the numbers that in many other northeastern states, but I think this time we're going to see a little bit different, particularly in congressional races and in legislative races. There's a lot of women candidates who are out there either already announced or poised to announce. So that mix might change in 2018.
Ryan, you wrote about some women running in the 16th Congressional District. Again, this is near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But the thesis of your story, The Dead Enders, was about how Democratic Party leaders essentially keep out progressive candidates. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm not exactly sure why they do it, but the way they do it is by as soon as a particular preferred candidate announces, they will have often at their event where they're announcing their candidacy, they'll have several of the kind of movers and shakers from the region, and then around the state, you will have statements pour in from the congressional delegation, from people like Ed Rendell, that all signal, okay, this is the person that we're getting behind in this race. In Christina Hartman's case, it was, I think, pretty much every member of the congressional delegation who was Democrat, endorsed her in this Lancaster district, as did Ed Rendell, as did, Katie McGinty. And so it sets in motion this idea that this is the person that we think should be the primary winner. And once that's in motion, it becomes much easier for them to go to donors who are only casual observers of the district and say, oh, look, I have party support. Can you give me $2,700 for the primary and another $2,700 for the general? And that creates a snowball effect that is supposed to create an inevitability that then drives them into the general election. The energy at the grassroots level is the thing that is throwing that traditional approach out of whack this time around.
Well, do you agree with that, that there is some, TJ, some progressive enthusiasm particular candidates, whether King or anybody else?
No, 100%. Ryan's absolutely. There's two. I want to wholeheartedly agree that the enthusiasm, the moment, the numbers of people, not just showing up at public meetings to raise their voice, but showing up to put their names on the ballot, is incredibly high, and it is the progressive base that is largely responsible for much of that. The only thing, I don't mean to disabuse Ryan of the notion that the winks and the nods, and when Rendell says this, we all jump. It just isn't. Maybe some people react that way, but I can tell you in the last 2 weeks, I've had three people call me, all of whom Ed Rendell has endorsed, none of whom I have any interest in. So, like, there's not this sort of, like, club where Eddie winks and then Joey nods and then we all fall in line. It just, you know, I think part of the reason people like Christina Hartman is she ran before. She got to know these. Part of it is about building relationships and then using those relationships to your advantage, whether it be in business or in politics. So the notion that we all – that somehow everybody jumps in line, I would respectfully dispute. And the reason that people like this woman is – I don't know her, but from what I've been told, she's really nice. She's a good candidate, and she represents – she ran a reasonably good race in a tough year last time. So I don't know that you hold that against.
Go ahead, Ryan, and then, John, I want to get you in on this as well.
Yeah, and I think that's very well said, and it's a complex dynamic, you know, how these endorsements come about, and just simply Ed Rendell would not be sufficient to get establishment support across the board. It's more of an accumulation of all of these different people who get behind you. Right. And yes, some of them get behind you for a lot of complicated reasons. They knew you in 2016. You ran that race. But what's fascinating here is that, yes, she ran in 2016. Yes, she raised an extraordinary amount of money for that district. She underperformed Hillary Clinton by running on the same strategy as Hillary Clinton, by trying to appeal to independents and moderate Republicans. And yes, they knew who she was. They knew she was talented. They knew she's a nice lady. They knew she, you know, ran a pretty good campaign in 2016. They also knew she lost, knew she underperformed Hillary Clinton, knew there was a ton of grassroots energy, and said, well, let's go with her again. It, rather than saying, let's rethink, you know, how we might have done things in the past and gotten where we are, and take a look at what else is happening. Instead of, you know, taking that moment to reflect, a lot of these elements of the party jumped in behind her, and the grassroots were like, well, go ahead. You know, good luck with that candidate. We have a different one, and we'll see you on election day.
But we can't run this experiment, Ryan, and I don't want to get too in the weeds here, but we don't know how Jess King in 2016 would have done against the incumbent, whether she would have
Right, and
lost
it's a different
in,
world, too, yeah, because you didn't have
and
the
And it's 2016, and here we are 2018.
Right.
John, do you want to get in on this about just how you see, progressive candidates in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it all comes down to the candidate, him or herself, Marty. I mean, I think increasingly the endorsements or individuals speaking up, I mean, think of, in the broadest possible sense, think of who would people trust or believe to say this is who you should vote for these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the exception of the extremes in either parties, I can't think of a figure either statewide or nationally that could come in and be a real factor in somebody's election. If you look at that 18th congressional out in western Pennsylvania, in Trump country, I mean, the vice president's been in, the president's been in, and he's coming back. That works, but if you're a Democrat, who do you send out there to make the case against electing a Trump-like candidate? I can't think of a single person, maybe Joe Biden. But so, I mean, I think that generally speaking, it really is dependent on the candidate. Mm. I mean, John Fetterman, the mayor of Braddock, who ran for the United States Senate in a primary and did surprisingly well, is running for lieutenant governor. He is extraordinarily progressive, but he has a quality to him that is so down to earth that kind of the politics almost becomes secondary to his presence. And there are other candidates like that, and I think that there are more factors than ideology that play out in a campaign, particularly for Democratic candidates.
And I have to say to our listeners and our guest, T.J. Rooney, a former chair of the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania, completely agreeing with you, John Baer.
Yeah, it just happens to be true. I mean, the quality of the – I don't – and listen, I'll tell you as a tactician, somebody who once practiced the sport – I don't care if you are 17 feet tall, green, and have three eyes and one in the middle of your forehead. If you have I don't care who you, if you can win, if you're a good person, you can put together the right team and win. That's all that really matters. That's how we're judged at the end of the day, whether you win or lose, not if you came in second. So I agree with John. It's the quality and the strength of the candidate that determines whether you win or lose, whether you're progressive or not.
Or not. Let me get Walter from West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Walter. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering, could you guess what the real story behind Bob Brady not running for re-election is? I mean, he's got about the safest seat there is in Philadelphia. He's the competitor of the party. He hasn't had a challenger in, you know, ever. So why is he leaving? Mm. And does Bob Jr. have any interest in running for the seat?
John Berica, I know you can't speak for Bob Brady, a very a powerful presence here in Philadelphia. What do you make of the fact that he's not running for re-election?
Well, you're right. I can't speak for him. Bob has a true history of being quite able to speak for himself.
Indeed, he has.
I just think it's a combination of things. I mean, there was this investigation that apparently he's totally clear of now. There is the whole redistricting thing, which has the potential of being total chaos. He's been involved in those efforts in the past. I guess he's just had enough. You know, sometimes when a politician says, I want to spend time with my family or my grandchildren, sometimes that might be right. I mean, we always make fun of that and we always mock it. But there could be things in Bob's personal life that nobody knows about or that his close friends know about. I'm not among them. I've always liked him. I've always gotten along with him. So, you know, we don't know. But my guess is it's a whole mix of things.
What do you think, TJ?
We've traded some messages over the course of the last few weeks, and I do agree with John. I just think it's a combination of a lot of things. But let me say this, because I know it's not often very in vogue or popular. I am really worried about the day that he leaves as the city chairman. I mean, his service in the Congress is noble and decent and honorable, and it'll be missed. But his ability to keep things together, and nobody always agrees with him, but that's usually a true test of a real leader. The things that he is able to do in this city and how what he's able to do affects our statewide politics are profound. I pray, I'll say a novena if I have to, that Bobby Brady stays around at least through 2020 as the city chairman in the city of Philadelphia, wow, or else our statewide politics are in for a big change.
Well, I want to pick up on that, and I'm Marty Moscone, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Ryan, let me go back to you and even go back to another special election. This was in Alabama in 2017. Does that tell us anything about the state of politics or even liberal, progressive, Democratic politics?
You know, it shows that Democrats should play everywhere. You know, Doug Jones was a serious candidate rather than just kind of a straw person that they threw up on the ballot because they had to, and then you had, you know, the events unfold that made it a winnable seat, and it also shows that you don't have to be entirely Republican light to win in Alabama. This is somebody who stood up for reproductive rights, for instance. You know, he ran as a pro-choice candidate in Alabama, which everyone had said was completely impossible, that if you want to be a Democrat who wins somewhere like that, you have to, you know, toe the Republican line on abortion rights. And so he didn't, and I think that helped get out Democratic supporters who otherwise might have said, oh, well, I hate Roy Moore, but this guy, mm-hmm, you know, is just not worth wasting a Tuesday afternoon going to the polls for. And so if 10 or 20,000 Democrats who otherwise would have stayed home were energized to go out because of that, you know, then that made the difference in the election.
Well, we're almost out of time here too, John Baer. So do you anticipate a kind of exciting election season this year in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I think on a lot of levels we're going to have a lot of fun. As you mentioned very at the top of the show, Marty, you've got a bunch of retirements in the Southeast, in the state House and Senate, that are going to open. You're going to have some open seat races, which is very rare for our legislature. Got a bunch of congressmen who have left either voluntarily or not so voluntarily, so you've got some open seats for congressional offices, also very rare. So I think we're going to have an exciting season, and this goes without mentioning a race for governor and a United States Senate race. So buckle up.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll get back to that sometime later in the year. John Baer, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. Ryan Grimm, thank you for joining us as well.
Yeah, thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. D.C. Bureau Chief at The Intercept and T.J. Rooney, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Marty. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to talk to you as well. Political strategist for the Rooney Novak Group. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.